This week in Retronauts, call me Death, because it's all about the fours. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. That intro didn't work as well as I thought it was going to on the spur of the moment. Let's try a different one. This week in Retronauts, call me a golfer because it's all about the fours. Ah, there we go. Okay, that's much better. All right, so anyway, we're here, and by we I mean us, talking about the years 1984 and 1994. As you may recall from a previous episode published not too long ago, we have spoken about 1974 and parts of 1984, but we did not finish that conversation, and so we are here to resume it and segue on a decade ahead, and that's where we're going to cut it off because Bob Mackie has already recorded a conversation about 2004, and that would just be a traffic jam of confusion if we had multiple conversations about the same thing. The Retronauts would never cover the same topic more than once. Just, that's unthinkable. Not going to do it. And actually, not going to do it is kind of in between the two dates we're talking about here. We're just going to totally elide over George Bush number one. And two, actually, because we're skipping 2004. So, good times ahead. Enjoy the podcast. Thanks for joining, everyone. Good night. Oh, wait. No, we haven't started.
Oh, that was easy.
Sorry. It's been a long day for me, and it's only 8:30 a.m., it's just, yeah, it's going to be rough. So I'm Jeremy Parrish, which I probably have mentioned before, but if not, that's me. And this is kind of ostensibly a Retronauts East episode. There's also Retronauts East Plus and Retronauts Far East. So it's about as east as you get this episode. Let's start moving in concentric circles further and further away from me, the host, as we live in a heliocentric universe, and my middle name is actually Helios. So here also, just kidding, Diamond. My middle name is actually Jeremy. My first name is Helios.
Helios Jeremy.
Yes, exactly. H. Jeremy Parrish. That's what the kids call me back in school. Anyway, here also in the triangular space known as the triangle, we have...
I'm Jared Petty from Limited Run Games, and for those unfamiliar, the triangle is the Raleigh area in eastern North Carolina.
It's also an instrument that you can use to very limited effect. Moving a little further out to a place a little further north along the eastern seaboard, we have...
This is Kevin Bunch, and I am quantum leaping from year to year in a desperate attempt to get home.
That's pretty much Retronauts in a nutshell. Every episode ends with us saying, oh boy. Let's see. Let's just skip straight across the Atlantic and the ruins of Atlantis and speak to our UK correspondent.
Hi, I'm Stuart Jupp, and Kevin Bunch never returned home.
Wow. Ouch.
Harsh. Wow, spoilers. are we at the series finale already? Can't believe it. All right, it's been a great podcast, everyone. Then finally, even further east, so far east, it might as well be west, because that's the way I have to fly to get there. We have our Japan correspondent.
And Epic Stan Diamond Fight. Hello.
Epic?
Epics.
Epics. E-P-Y-X. Oh, Epics. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. See, my brain is on Epoch.
Oh, like Fortnite.
And no one, no, as in the cassette vision, and no one should be standing that.
Oh, I just unlocked Peter Griffin, so I will be standing it all day long.
So, we, like I said, have covered 1984 to some degree. We're going to touch up on the rest of that. But it occurs to me, after seeing some of the notes, that Stuart and Diamond have not actually been on one of these year-end reviews in review, right? Is that correct?
I was on the 2004 one, and I think I was on the 2003 one, but that was like yesterday. So
you've been on the ones hosted by Bob, whose format is a little different than mine, because my format has evolved through the years as I've discovered that if we try to go in depth about everything, it would actually take the entire year to get through these reviews. So So what we're going to do is kind of cover 84, the dregs, the remnants, the detritus, and then move on to 94. And I've broken 94 into really three different categories, besides just kind of the general, what the hell was happening on planet Earth in 1994? There's consoles, computers, and arcades. And I've asked each person on this show to pick one or two items from each of those categories in each year to lead the discussion on. We used to try, like I said, to talk about everything in those years, and that just can't happen because we are a mouthy bunch. I mean, I haven't even given anyone else a chance to speak yet, and we're like 10 minutes into the show. So as you can see, we are all hoist by my petard. So because of my petard, you guys have to kind of rein it in a little bit. So we're gonna hit the high points, the really important, cool stuff, or maybe the really unimportant, uncool stuff that just means a lot to us. That's the thing. So we're going to jump into 1984 and finish up that conversation. I believe episode, I want to say 579 was the previous years in review for 74. Oh, 582. My God, I totally got my numbers wrong. So check that episode out. And now we are going to mosey on into the stuff that we didn't discuss in 84, which was myself and Kevin and Binge Edwards, who can't be here due to family conflicts. So everyone else, what the hell were you doing in 1984?
Very little, due to not being born.
That is no excuse.
In 1984, I was plugging away on a Coleco Atom, the finest of all computer systems, which my family had wisely chosen at that point as our household PC. I was buying remaindered ColecoVision games for a dollar each, and enjoying them in my console/computer hybrid. I was playing the Buck Rogers Planet of Zoom super game on cassette at home. I was fooling around with the word processor and the very, very, very loud printer.
The daisy wheel.
Yeah. I know a lot of you are imagining a dot matrix, but that thing had a daisy wheel. It had a typewriter printer. And it was like, it sounded like a Tommy gun. Like when they talk about like a Chicago typewriter, they're not exaggerating with the printer for the Atom. It's the loudest thing ever.
I thought it was like Chicago Book of, you know, Manual of Style. It's actually like Chicago, like Mafia.
Oh, that's what you call a Tommy gun. It's a Chicago typewriter.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
for the rat-tat-tat sound that it made. Yeah.
Not having been in the mob in the 1920s, I did not know that.
Yeah.
I think someone hasn't played Resi 4 enough.
That's correct. Or maybe I've played it just enough.
So I was doing that, and then I was traveling to arcades with my family and uncle and playing lots and lots and lots of wonderful, wonderful arcade games that year. Not so much the games that came out that year, although I did play a few of them, but the fact that at that point the 1980 to 83 classics were in there with the new batch, and it was just one of the best times to walk into an arcade. They hadn't gotten rid of like Centipede and Pac-Man yet, but you also had the brand new stuff. It was an amazing time to go to arcades.
All right. And Diamond, yourself?
Well, I would have been in the third grade, I believe, and 1984 is one of the earliest years I can actually remember, like, as a year, because of there was so much going on. There were two Olympics, one of which is a country no longer exists, and we had an election that was kind of pointless, and it was just so much. And I recall, video game wise, I'm sure I spent the bulk of my year playing the Commodore 64 because obviously I didn't have an NES yet because no one did. And I didn't import a Famicom because I wasn't that kind of kid. But I'm sure I played a lot of computer games and arcade games whenever I could find them. And probably even some Atari games. There are probably some leftover Atari games I was still plugging away at. And all in all, I was pretty satisfied with the state of the 1980s because I was, you know, I was a dumb kid. I didn't know any better.
There you go. Yeah, 84 was a very memorable year for me, too. I do remember things before that, but 84 was kind of where everything became concrete. Maybe because that's the year we got a color television, and all of a sudden television was in color as opposed to monochrome. But also, that was the very brief period of my life where I liked baseball, and the Detroit Tigers were good back then. I don't know if they're good anymore, but they were good, very, very good for that year. And so I actually went to pro baseball games and saw them when we went up to visit family in Michigan, and that was cool. And that's the last time I thought sports were interesting. So now we're going to talk about other things that are much more interesting, namely video games, because they're like sports, but you play them by sitting around and just only using your thumbs. And that's amazing. The human body, what a powerhouse. We can do so much with so little effort. So, 1984, I don't think we really talked about the computer industry for 84. We talked about consoles because there just wasn't so much to talk about when it came to consoles in 84 and also arcade games. But the computer business was really kind of blowing up and there was a lot of stuff happening. First and closest to my heart being the debut of the Apple Macintosh, which, really should have been just an amazing system for games, but due to Steve Jobs and everyone else being a little weird about video games, didn't really ever quite realize its potential. But still, the games that it did give us were very influential in some conceptual ways. So we will talk about the Apple Macintosh very briefly because Jared Petty has put his name down to talk about the Apple Macintosh. Jared Petty, go for it.
84 is my favorite year for computers ever. I love this year. So many amazing American computers, so many amazing things happen. The original Mac is kind of useless. They put too little RAM in it because they couldn't figure out how to make it affordable to put more in, or internal business purposes, or God knows. It depends on whether you're asking which Steve Jobs movie or what book. But they put 128K RAM in it, which was barely enough to run the operating system. So you had room left for about 8 pages of text in MacWrite, or like 1 or 2 pictures in Mac Paint. And that didn't lend itself very well to games.
You got yourself a pretty convincing Zork right there.
I mean, yeah, you can get Zork out of it because you can keep most of the data on a disk and just stream some text into a window.
Wait, but did that one have an integrated disk drive, or was that the model that we had to have an external disk drive because Steve Jobs was like, no moving parts ever?
It had an integrated disk drive. Wait, the first one might have had an external, come to think of it. Oh, you may be right, Jeremy, because he didn't want to – there was no fan.
No drives, no fans, right, nothing none that of them moves work or makes anymore. Noise.
Yeah, none of them work anymore because they didn't. He wouldn't put a fan in them. He'd already destroyed the Apple III this way, completely wrecked the company. But the Mac is amazing. A Mac was an outer space computer to most home computer people. We'd not seen the like of it. That high resolution screen, that graphical interface, the fake demo where it talked to you, those were space age concepts in computing. People wrote long treatises and marketing pieces on the mouse so that we would understand what it was and how it worked. And computing was about to get friendly and simple. And if Mac had been able to put 256K in that thing first time around, I think it would have been a lot more successful. Or if they'd been given the price down a little bit. It's too damn expensive for what it could do. And there wasn't any software ready for it.
You know, they could have saved millions of dollars by not hiring Ridley Scott to make their commercial.
That too. A year later, when Multiplan and then a little after that, when Excel ran on it, when PageMaker came along in a couple of years, and when there was some RAM in the thing, and they managed to speed it up a little, it was a great computer for doing all kinds of work. But in 1984, it was a prophecy. It was a curiosity, and everyone that bought it was a fool. And because of that...
This has been the case for every Apple 1.0 product throughout history. They set the pattern right here.
They really did. And it's you know, you couldn't play much on it. They put Through the Looking Glass on it, which I have... It's you're just moving chess pieces very rapidly around a board. It looks like a strategy game, but it's an action game. It's kind of like chess hockey. It's not good. It looks neat. It's very beautiful in that one bit. You know, one it's true black and white. People forget about the Mac that it doesn't have shades of gray. It's just black and white. It's just that high res fools you with dithering, and so things look deeper than they are, and it's very beautiful. But another thing to keep in mind with this is that that I want to reinforce. A year earlier, the Apple IIe came out, which was a iteration, a 1977 technology that they neglected for 6 years because they wanted to leave it behind. At this point, the Apple IIe is selling, heading into the millions, and it is keeping the company alive. That's what's floating Apple, a seven-year-old computer at this point with thank God, that double high-res upgraded graphics processor now in it. So you can get way prettier and multiple color graphics out of your Apple now that look way better than what you could do on a 2E a few years ago. You can expand the thing to all the hell. It's around this time, it's up to 128K of RAM standard and 80 column standard. So it's a fine business computer. You do much more with it for business than a Mac, and there's way more software. And this is floating Apple until the Macintosh can come into its own. So I talked a lot there. I'm going to shut up now.
I just want to jump in here and say that for years, I liked to point out the fact that Nintendo liked to follow in Apple's footsteps. And here we see, you know, a hint of what was going to come 15 years later when the ancient Game Boy was keeping Nintendo afloat during the difficult N64 years. So once again, Nintendo following Apple's lead.
There we go.
And let's look, sheer coincidence. So I'm sure this was the year that my elementary school opened a computer lab, and I'm pretty sure it was full of 2Es, and we didn't have any color screens, so we had these monitors, which were basically, you know, different shades of green. So there's another Game Boy connection right there. It was all just, you know, I was being trained. I was being trained 5 years early for what I'd be doing.
Someday, you will catch them all.
Well, the Apple II has such an odd graphics display in general that it thinks it's a monochrome machine, even when it's color. And I'm not even going to begin to describe how that works, but it's a trick that allows it to have beautiful monochrome graphics and beautiful color graphics on the same games. And literally the resolution changes between them. And so you get this gorgeous, gorgeous look to a lot of those monochrome games. And Apple II gaming, Apple IIe gaming is huge this year, and that's a lot of what's propping this up. And then as we move into next year in schools, by the time schools all have 2Es, it's Oregon Trail and Speedway Math and Number Munchers and the Mech games that are keeping Mac alive. It's largely a gaming and small business computer, even this late, which is weird. Or not Mac, pardon me, the Apple II. The Mac becomes a gaming computer next year with things like, you know, Balance of Power, which is one of the all-time great video games. Shadowgate, which is not, but is really atmospheric and neat. Stuff like that.
All right, so that's how things looked on the American side. Everyone was agog over the Macintosh, even though they didn't actually buy it. Stuart, walk us through what was going on in the UK, because they had computers there too.
Well, I mean, I only know sort of with hindsight what was going on at all in the UK. I mean, looking at the list that's here, it's a big one. I mean, Jetpack, Attic Attack, and Saberwolf are probably like, I mean, they're all from Ultimate Play the Game, which later became Rareware. They're all included on Rare Replay, and the reason being, other than history, is they're some of the few Spectrum games that are still actually quite fun, particularly Jetpack, which is, I would play Jetpack anytime and enjoy myself. Attic Attack is a top-down flick-screen game that's all right. Saberwolf is probably the simplest of them, which is just a sort of basic maze game with really beautiful visuals that avoid the kind of general color clash thing. But Jetpack is the one to go back to, and it's there's a remake remake of it, but honestly, the original is fine. Like, it really doesn't have any... It's very Spectrum, so you get that kind of experience, and you get that feel, but you also don't have to contend with the usual nonsense that you would normally have to put up with the clashing and the slowdown and such. The slowdown that is there just makes the game more playable, frankly, because otherwise it would be nearly impossible. But it's a really simple single-screen shooting-slash-collecting game that just gets progressively more difficult as you build this rocket and then sort of stock it with fuel. Elite coming out this year is wild. It's not the sort of game I ever really got into because it's sort of too complex for my interests, but David Braben, programmer, I believe, I'm sure everyone knows what Elite is because it got an Esport as well, or was that Europe only? I'm not sure. But
Elite did, yeah, get an NES port, but only in Europe.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. I can't even imagine how they managed to get that on a joypad, but I'll worry about that later.
Yeah, they brought it over here on some computers because eventually I played it. And loved it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a game with a long tail. It's been going. I mean, we had Elite, and then I think it was Frontiers, and all the way up to Elite Dangerous. And I understand the basic premise is that you're sort of heading through space, interacting with other ships, docking, buying things, trading things, that sort of thing. And it's not my sort of thing at all, because you don't jump on anything. So, I mean, maybe you can. Do you jump on things in Elite?
No. Elite is, you're spending pretty much all your time in a cockpit shooting down wireframe spaceships and buying low and selling high. It's like Drug Wars in space with 3D graphics in 1984. It's another one of those games that felt impossible, like, for the time.
Yeah, it was the big BBC Micro game.
Yes.
You know, they didn't have too many on that thing that were really like, this is the reason to have this computer. But Elite was that.
Yeah. I guess one of the few BBC Micro games that wasn't like an educational schools tool. But I mean, the big one for me in 84, looking at the list, is Jet Set Willy, which is the most British game ever made, possibly. in terms of like.
From the cover art, really.
Yeah, it's a sequel to Manic Miner, which is probably one of my favorite Speccy games that was from the previous year. Programmed by Matthew Smith, who is this kind of odd programmer for Bug Bite Software, who after he made this essentially disappeared off the map and became a recluse for a very, very long time. And I think it was Retro Gamer magazine that tracked him down, and he was just like, no, I wasn't a recluse, I just finished. Like, I had nothing to say. but Jet Set Willy, what that is a flick screen platform game in which you play as Manic Miner, who's been demanded by his nagging wife, look, I didn't make it, that he's got to tidy up the house before he comes to bed.
Actually, I think it's his housekeeper, isn't it?
Oh, it's his housekeeper, isn't it?
His housekeeper demands that he clean up his house, which, you know, I kind of feel like, why have you hired this person? If
that's a really good point.
Hassling you to do their job for them.
I didn't spend too much time reading the cassette in late, I must be honest.
There's some lore going on. For sure.
It might be like that Seinfeld episode where he hires the maid and then eventually the relationship turns naughty. I don't know.
Listen, you know, housekeepers, it's like anything. You have to clean up the house before the cleaners come to clean the house. So
Understand that behavior. Why do people do that?
Do what?
Clean up. Yeah, well, I don't understand that behavior either. But I don't understand cleaning up before the housekeeper comes over, cleaning the hotel room before the housekeeper comes in.
I'm kind of with you on that one. Maybe it's like a social, like, we want to think we're untidy, but not too untidy.
Right, and I guess it could also depend on the nature of the items you have laying about.
The conversation is steered away from the topic, which is,
I'm sorry,
can you see Willy on the cover of Jet Set Willy? I need to know.
There is Minor Willy with his head in a toilet, presumably having drank too much alcohol.
Yeah.
But
no, he's clutching a bottle, actually.
Well, he's going to vomit and then he's going to pull it back out, have a bit more, you know, there's a cycle going on. Speaking of cycle, getting back on topic a sec. Minor Willy, Jet Set Willy is this unbelievably, like, unbearably, fastidiously difficult flip screen platform. I think there's about 60 screens, and about three of them are bugged. So if you go in them, you've just your game might just be ruined. That was a thing that was initially passed off as a feature, because I remember that it was in like Crash Magazine. Their statement was like, these rooms are dangerous rooms filled with poison gas, so if you go in them, there's a chance you might fail. And then later it was like, no, actually, we just made a mistake. Here are the pokes to type in to fix it. So what is more Spectrum than a game about a man vomiting while also being unwinnable without using cheats that have been issued later by the publisher? I love it. It's still fun, even though it's impossible. Don't expect to finish it. There's another bug where if you basically, when you enter a screen, that's your spawn point if you die. So if you fall from another screen and land on an obstacle, you will just lose all your lives in quick succession as you fall, respawn above the pit until you die.
I think that inspired that one stage in Atlantis No Nazo that was deliberately designed to do that.
I think that inspired real life murders, probably. It's really bad. But yeah, my advice for Jet Set Willy, if you haven't played it, start the game, try and find this screen called the Banyan Tree, which is quite early on. And if you can beat it, prove it, and I will give you £100.
No,
I won't do that. I'm not giving you my money.
I was playing it for research earlier this year. It had been a while, and I understand Brexit now.
I mean, it's one of those games where I can get reasonably far into it because of the sheer level of Stockholm syndrome and patience that I've got for games like this. It's why I'll play stuff like this and I'll just kind of go, what's everyone whinging about? It's fine. It's absolutely fine. The extent of abuse to which I will tolerate from a video game.
You wrote a book about stuff like this.
I did write a book about this. All games are good, available now.
I like Jet Set Willy well enough. Like
I love it. When I bought
a Spectrum, this is one of the first games I loaded up, and you know, it is extremely difficult. I will probably never beat it, but it's very charming. You know, it's got very cute. I don't know if cute's the best word for it, but it has very interesting graphics and enemies, and the animation at the end when you lose with the boots is pretty great. Yeah, I can understand why a kid would think this is such a great game.
Compared to Manic Miner, which I do prefer, which is a single screen game with like 20 levels in a row, very beautifully designed game. And Jet Set Willy is so sort of, I'm going to say sloppy by comparison, because we've gone from 20 like condensed levels to 60 huge sprawling ones full of bugs. It's incredibly ambitious by comparison. I guess it's kind of like going from, this is the stupidest comparison ever, but I guess it's like going from Vice City to San Andreas in terms of size. But ultimately, it's very difficult to recommend as a experience, like a sit down and play this, you'll have fun kind of experience. And at Jetpack, though, you can play it today and you'll have a ball. Yeah. It's great fun. It's probably the best Spectrum game that I can think of. And I don't like saying that because I want to say it's Bangers and Mash or something, but I want to say it's Dizzy, but it's not. It's Jetpack.
You sure it's not Horace Goes Skiing?
That must have been difficult.
It was difficult, thank you. And Horace Goes Skiing, we don't talk about Horace Goes Skiing.
So going from one impossibly opaque game to another, Kevin, take us through the Tower of Draga and Pac-Land. What was going on with these Namco people? They made some innovative, revolutionary games that hated us.
Yes, so this was the year Namco published Pac-Land and Tower of Draga in Japan. Pac-Land did come out in the U.S. as well through Midway, and it is dramatically different from all of the previous Pac-Man games because it is no longer a maze game, but it's a platform game where Pac-Man is running along and he's, you know, dodging obstacles and jumping on platforms. And once he gets to the end of the, you know, screen and everything, he just turns around and runs right back because he's got to go back home. And Draga is sort of a maze game where you have enemies and you have different requirements for clearing each stage, but also for finding the object that you need to get on to the next stage, which is remarkably opaque, and it does not give you any hints whatsoever. And both of these games became very influential for especially Japanese developers. You know, Nintendo pulled a lot from both of these games, most obviously with Pac-Land. For Super Mario Brothers, I know Shigeru Miyamoto has talked about how the visual design of Super Mario Brothers was very much taken from Pac-Land and its blue skies and its colorful ground and trees and all that fun stuff. Tower of Draga, though, boy, everybody in Japan was aping
this. The wrong lessons.
Yes. So this is sort of the origin of the hidden objects design mentality that you see in a lot of Famicom games. So, like, Super Mario is fairly straightforward with it. Like, here's some hidden blocks. If you get them, you get little bonuses. Zelda, they took from that, like, oh, we could just hide shops and eventually dungeons behind, you know, just random cliff walls and trees. And
yeah, I like when they're hidden inside of a tree, and until you get the magic candle at the end, you can burn one tree per screen before you have to go off the screen and come back to reset the candle. There might be, you know, 50 trees on a single screen.
Yeah, it's agonizing. And then you go from there, you get stuff like Mylon's Secret Castle, which is just all hidden blocks. You have Super Zevius, also by Namco, which takes from Juaga for the concept of you have to do some arbitrary secret thing to advance further in the game. You have Takeshi's Challenge, which is sort of the ultimate expression of this particular design mentality. You know, Castlevania 2's got weird little hidden secrets that are poorly explained, like you know, kneeling at the cliffside, which I guess that's more explanation than anything you get in Draga. But it's also known for having this sort of communal aspect to its play, because it became a huge hit for a reason, and that was just because, you know, people would share information, you know, both verbally and in some cases they'd have literal notebooks set up near the cabinets, and they would just mark down what they'd figured out how to get through each screen. I could understand why, you know, this got passed on for Western release with this in mind, but yeah, it's one of those games where Japanese folks have a lot of nostalgia and respect for it, despite it being kind of awful to play any time outside of its original context. And it did get a couple of sequels that are a little more friendly and interesting.
If that notebook thing traveled overseas, I don't think that they would be full of polite, like, hints for the game. If it was Britain, you'd be like, okay, what do I do on this screen? Oh, it's a penis. What about the next screen? Oh, that's a penis again. Just, it would be an awful scene, and it's a
shame.
There
would also be some boobs.
There would be breasts, yes, granted.
I mean, to be fair, I'm sure the Japanese notebooks were also full of penises and boobs, but they probably also had some useful information in there mixed in.
And they were probably drawn more, you know, artfully, too.
I mean, if they weren't, I'd feel a bit sort of despairing at humanity in a way. Like, obviously, that's what you would do.
Yeah, in an arcade, maybe. I you know, Japanese love hotel diaries are very rarely dirty. They're usually, like, all esoteric and mournful, but very rarely have any penises in them.
Love hotel diaries?
Yeah, a lot of love hotel rooms will have journals in it that people can write in. Yeah.
You have my attention.
Yeah.
I never heard of this.
Very much.
Can we change the subject of this podcast completely?
Very much like the arcade, they're kind of like little confessionals people have written in. Okay, they're not nearly in every one, but I've seen them in once before.
I just got to get a plane ticket.
Anyway, Draga is part of one of those things that the only way to experience it properly was to be there one time, and it just feeds into my manic desire to be reborn in Japan just in time to hit, like, peak 80s bubble Japan at the right age to soak in the cocaine in excess. Well, not the cocaine, because that's illegal.
Yeah,
but the excess.
I don't think they really did a lot of cocaine there.
No,
they
not a lot of cocaine.
It in, really.
They were drinking a lot. You got to give them that.
Yeah, but it was an amazing time and an amazing place, and it just this kind of time capsule bubble sounds rad. I wish I could have been there for it.
I do love the communal, like, the communal thing in games like this and in microcomputer games of this era. I don't know how much the influence is sort of going back and forth. I mean, obviously, Draga is incredibly influential, but there were British games before this that were similarly sort of esoteric. So I think it's just a natural compulsion towards, like, conundrums and puzzles that arose in people making and playing video games. It's just kind of cool.
Yeah, it seemed to be something in the water in Japan at the time, because 1984 also saw, it wasn't cocaine, it was probably just sake. maybe the sake replaced the water. Anything is possible. It was a magical time. So on the home computer front, you had games like Dragon Slayer and Hydlide and the Black Onyx, all of which drew from Western RPG traditions, but skewed them in different ways that were better suited to the Japanese audience. I mean, the Black Onyx was pretty much just wizardry, except with Japanese text, which, you know, that's a good step right there, playing a dense, complex, difficult RPG that involves lots of mapping and lots of skill development. Like, having that in your native language, that's really beneficial.
Yeah.
But Dragon Slayer and Hydlide, like the Tower of Draga, shifted the idea of RPGs from text and menus to a direct action style. Like Hydlide, you know, kind of predated the Ys series by introducing bump combat, where literally you just walk into a monster, and if you hit it with your sword and you're strong enough, you will kill the monster. And if you don't do it right, then it will hurt you back. And that's really, really simplified. Really kind of a real-time version of what you saw in Rogue, which I know did make it over to Japan around this time. So that might have been one of the influences there as well. And then you had Dragon Slayer, which is a strange, strange game where in the wizardry games and other games like that, Bard's Tale, etc., there's a town where the game begins. And you kind of use that town as the hub. You go back to the town or, you know, whatever, to buy things, to rest at the inn, to level up and so forth. Dragon Slayer gives you the town in the form of your house, but you have the ability to pick up your house and carry it around with you as an item. You can pick up one item at a time in the dungeon and carry it around with you. So maybe you have like a cross that will, you know, scare monsters away, but then that means you can't pick up the tokens you need to take back to the house to gain experience and level up. So there's this kind of risk reward, like sometimes you want to drag the house with you and keep it close to a place where there are a lot of tokens to collect. But you become vulnerable while you carry your house around, as you might. Mm-hmm. So it just has this very strange, interesting design loop. It's very, and also this was one of the games that introduced the opacity and unfriendliness of enemy leveling that you see in games like Saga or even Final Fantasy VIII, where as you go through the dungeon, you can kill monsters and, you know, it's a very simple kind of bump combat like Hydlide. And if you're stronger than them, you'll kill them. Cool. But the thing is, when you kill a monster in the maze, it is replaced somewhere else in the maze by another monster. But that other monster, the replacement, is one tier of power stronger than the monster you kill. So the more monsters you kill, the more powerful the monsters you face become. And it's not just like every monster is leveling up alongside you. It's literally a case of there is a set number of monsters in this maze, and they will, you know, the weak enemies as you destroy them will just never return. Instead, they will be reborn as a monster at a higher tier of difficulty. So, it kind of forces you to question, hey, should I stab this little skeleton guy because he might come back as a dragon, which is way deadlier. So it's a strange game, but interesting and also very influential, and continues it sort of to run even now as the Legends of Heroes Trails games. Not really, but Dragon Slayer was designed by, oh shoot, what was his name? Yoshio Kiya, that's it. And all of the games that he designed really had nothing to do with each other, but he called all of them Dragon Slayer something, like Xanadu, Romancia, Legacy of the Wizard, etc. And eventually they landed at Legend of Heroes, which was, I think, Dragon Slayer 6. And that's pretty much a standard turn-based RPG, and that's kind of where you've gone at this point. Anyway, we went from strange to fairly standard, but you know, at least we took the detour. Anyway, I do want to wrap up 1984 because it was supposed to be like a sidebar and it's already like half the episode. So Fight, please stand for Epics for us.
Yeah. I just wanted to highlight two games that happen to come from Epics. That's E-P-Y-X. And I think they were both originally made for Commodore 64, but appeared on many of the machines. One of them I've already mentioned on Retronauts a few months ago, which was Impossible Mission, not Mission Hell Impossible, yeah. Impossible Mission.
Yeah, don't get them mixed up.
Yeah. It's a very cryptic sort of platformer adventure game, and as a kid, I simply did not understand it at all, but I was still fascinated by it, and I kept trying to play it over and over again, and I really hope to, as an adult, I really want to try and tackle this with an actual manual and figure out how it works, because I feel like I owe it to myself to finally close that loop and figure out what the hell this game was even about.
What'd you play it on, Diamond?
I was playing Commodore 64.
So. Good, okay. That's the best version. Yeah, that's the one to play.
I really coveted the Master System version of this game when I was a kid, but I never did get it. I didn't get to play it till the remake on DS, I think. It was on DS. Same exact game, but like upgraded graphics, smoother graphics. Yeah. You know, Diamond, there's actually a book called Impossible Mission, The Official Guide, which is like a making of plus walkthrough. So that might be worth getting. It seems quite obscure, one of these print on demand sort of jobs. But yeah, it's good. Really interesting game and still really fun to play now today, I would say.
And yeah, I'm trying, kind of curious. I know there's a version for Switch, but I don't know if that's good or interesting at all. I just know there's something.
I think it's
Switch.
One of those pretty much direct emulation jobs. I don't remember who does them, but they're all over like Steam and Switch, and they're really not satisfying at all. Honestly, if you can find it, the DS one isn't that expensive, and I think it comes with the original on the cartridge, so it's worth looking for.
Oh, yeah. Well,
but it might be PAL only. It might be a PAL only thing. I don't know.
No, I've got a copy. I found it in the store here. So, I grew up on the 7800 version, so not only was it inscrutable, it was literally impossible to beat. So.
Oh, yeah, that's the one that's bugged,
is that the
right?
One with the bug?
Yes, yeah. That has a bug where one of the objects you need to beat the game is hidden behind one of the computer terminals, so you can't search for it.
Oh, God.
So that's fun.
But that's because the room is full of poison gas, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I played
just
that
like
version.
In Jet Set Willy.
I played that version so much, and like, I never got close to finishing it, but I would have been extremely mad if I did.
I like that. That's like The Simpsons, a wizard did it. If the game is unfinishable, it's because of poison gas.
It's one of those it was one of those PC games that they actually went to the trouble to make it a good Tandy port and make it all pretty. And that one has good sound and good color, too. That's a fun one to play.
Does it have the sample speech, like, really just iconic?
It doesn't sound... No, I had a PC speaker, so no, it doesn't sound awesome like the Sid version does the sample. As a matter of fact, the guy falls, it kind of sounds like he's going... like that. They try to do a human voice through the PC speaker, and it does not work.
Anyway, the other epic scheme I wanted to mention is called Summer Games, because like I said, there were Olympics that year, and Summer Games is a really just fun collection of various Olympic events, all, you know, summer themed, obviously. And to me, even as a kid, I noticed that whatever technology they use to animate the little guy in both these games is basically the same sort of sprite. So you basically have this little guy running and jumping. And oh, well, in this game, the little guy runs and jumps and like searches computers. But in this other game, he's running and jumping and, you know, using poles and jumping over hurdles and maybe, you know, I couldn't even tell you how many events are in the game off the top of my head, but I know there were a lot of them, and the computer version enabled us to, not only my friends could come over and we could all play together, we could name our own characters, and I think the game actually saved them to some degree. So if we set a record in a sport, you know, if we did something really, really good, we could play this game over and over again. We might not be able to break that record for many, many play sessions. But then if we did, the game would tell me, oh, you broke a record. Like, oh, we're getting better at this game. So it also included, you know, sort of chiptune-y versions of various national anthems. But they also included one for like a nation that they named for themselves. So it's like an Epics nation with an Epics flag. And it's just some sort of weird little, you know, tune. And I think we would use it sometimes just because that was weird to us. And it was like, oh, that, is that a real, you know, we didn't even know if that was even a real country, but you know, we figured it out.
I feel like I'd be really remiss if I didn't mention that both these games are on the first Evercade Commodore 64 cartridge, Summer Games and Impossible Mission. So that's one way to play them, I guess. I swear I don't work for Evercade and I'm not employed to promote them.
That, I think we can put a bow on 1984. There were many other things that happened in 1984. I didn't even touch on Sega's kind of divestment from Gulf and Western, or the fact that Capcom debuted and other cool stuff like that. Commodore bought the Amiga. All kinds of wild stuff happened that would have knock-on effects in video gaming. But it's time to move ahead a decade to the year 1994. From 80s cocaine excess to... how would we define 94?
90s cocaine excess. 90s heroin excess.
No, it was, I think everyone was on like, you know, just sugared up with Mountain Dew Code Red. No, not Code Red yet. Jolt Cola. I don't know.
90s Jolly Rancher excess.
Was Surge out yet? I remember Surge.
I believe so. This might have been the age of Orbitz also. Little gummy balls in your sugary water. I guess it was basically boba, but, bad. Anyway, so yeah, 1994, there is a list of things that people have added that happened in the year 1994 here in the notes, almost none of which have anything to do with video games. But go ahead and walk us through some of these things, folks.
Well, it's funny, Jeremy, you mentioned sports earlier that you actually like baseball. So 1994 was a really bad year to like baseball because they stopped playing baseball. Major League had a major strike, and in the August, they stopped playing, and they never started again for the rest of the year. So for the first time in 90 years, there was no World Series in 1994, which was really frustrating if you were a fan from New York or Montreal, because those two teams had a really great year, and especially Montreal, because shortly after that, they lost all their best players because that team was perpetually underfunded, and eventually the team would just move away from Montreal altogether. But that was like the year they seemed like they were really going to be going somewhere, and they just didn't get to do it, which is a real tragedy.
Where is the Montreal team now? And I guess they are no longer the Expos.
They became the Washington Nationals about 10, 15 years ago, I think.
Okay.
So
go Nats.
They have the logo that looks like Walgreens. It's great.
A little bit.
I always think they're like the Walgreens team whenever I see them on TV.
But in Washington, they did finally win the World Series, I want to say, in 2019. So they, you know, they got it. They got there eventually, but...
Yeah, I feel like Montreal made a huge mistake by naming their team the Expos. Like, when you name your team for an event that happened decades, you know, at a certain time, decades later, it's like, well, here's our former glory. Here's our baseball team that reminds us of when we did something cool once.
The Knoxville Wig Spheres.
I'm still mad they moved to Washington and split my market. The Orioles have never been the same since the Nationals came back from Montreal.
Hey,
took
great,
half the money from my team.
This means that I can always count on one team to be doing pretty well.
But speaking of tragedies, there was the rather unfortunate case of Los Angeles' most famous unsolved murder, when two people were killed on the evening of June 12th, and we never figured out who did it. It's just unfortunate.
Are they still looking for the murderer?
I'm sure there's a hotline still accepting tips to this day. But in this case, the suspect happened to run away from the police, and this turned into a major media event that also overlapped with Game 5 of the NBA Finals. So while I was trying to watch the Knicks in the goddamn finals, NBC decided, you know what, we'd rather show this van driving on the highway.
It was really more of a sport utility vehicle.
It's a Bronco. It's a Ford Bronco. And but in any case, you're watching. They decided to put the car in the big picture mode, and then the finals. They're the little picture in picture square in the corner. And I was just staring at them like, I want to watch the basketball that actually matters. I don't care about the man in the Bronco. And boy, do the next 2 years really suck for me not caring about the man in the Bronco, because he's going to come all over the news pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the famous co-star of the movie Airplane, correct?
The Naked Gun. He was the Naked Gun.
Oh, the Naked Gun. Yeah. Okay. So, Orenthal Simpson. So
this is. I mean, my understanding is this is unsold in name only. Like, it was really obvious that he did it. Like, he said he did. Like, he wrote a book about having done it.
This is a society where one is innocent until proven guilty.
Even if he was, you know, even in civil court, he was held responsible for those deaths, I believe. But
yes,
he is not criminally liable.
He lost a lot of money in that. But
all right, well, yeah. I guess I'll make that clear. If legally he didn't do it, but he definitely did kill those
It's
people.
Weird. Like, the burden of proof, if I understand it correctly, I'm going to caveat this. Civil court has a lower burden of proof than criminal court. So in criminal court, they weren't able to prove that he was guilty of murder. But in civil court, he was successfully sued for wrongful death.
Yes.
Wrongful death?
Yep. He had to give up a bunch of money to the families of the two victims.
That's
which I,
wild.
I don't think he actually did. I think they're still waiting for that money, actually.
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw much of that.
I'm really taken aback by this wrongful death. That's such an odd phrase.
That suggests there is also a rightful death, which...
Oh, there is.
I'd like to be tried for that someday.
I mean, according to Jodan Pachi, there's blissful death.
Yes, you did it. You did it, and it was deserved. Go well done. Yeah,
here's a gift certificate.
For the record, though, this man was later convicted of a crime, so you can describe him today as a convicted felon, but it wasn't. He's not a convicted murderer.
Oh yeah, wasn't he like robbing someone or something?
He was.
Why?
He robbed. He burgled, I think.
That's wild.
Anyway,
that crazy old O.J. Simpson.
What's probably more interesting from that year is that was the year that Pulp Fiction came out and won every prize except the Academy Award for Best Picture, because that went to Forrest Gump. And
not The Shawshank Redemption.
Also a very good movie. But
oh my God, what a year for cinema.
What really ended up happening is, I would say, for the next, let's say, 5 to 15 years, every movie decided they wanted to sound like the Pulp Fiction characters, which just really didn't work out that well. But you know, I think there's some good movies came out of this.
Such as?
This is not a movie podcast. I'm not going to go into it. But
that means you don't
Pulp
have
Fiction
any.
2, more pulpy.
But hey, the English Channel Tunnel was finished this year. That's pretty cool.
Was it 94 also the year of The Fugitive?
Was that?
That was 93.
I don't know.
93? Well, yep. I was still watching it in 94.
The Fugitive fever continues until 1994. Exactly.
Yeah, 94 was actually kind of a ridiculously stocked year for Best Picture, which is why it's all the more infuriating that Forrest Gump won, because like that's the one you watch today and you're like, really? Really?
So, yeah, that's exactly what happens.
You know, the technology of intersplicing Tom Hanks in with old footage, that blew some minds, and it's so commonplace today that it's right, kind of fascinating.
It's a controversial opinion, but I think Pulp Fiction is good. That's just me. That's what I think.
It's fine.
Very good.
Forrest
movie.
Gump is basically like if Billy Joel turned We Didn't Start the Fire into a movie. And I guess people really loved that. Anyway, Kevin, you were saying about the Chunnel. That's not to be mistaken for a chunder, is that correct?
Correct. This is the English Channel Tunnel between France and Britain. Yeah. Making it easy to travel between the mainland and the British Isles for, you know, the first time ever. Yeah,
for buying booze.
Little did they know what would happen 30 years later or 20 years later.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone could have seen that one coming.
The Channel Tunnel is there so that Brits can drive over there, fill their cars with cigarettes and booze, and drive back. That's all it's for.
Speaking of Brits, this was also the year, apparently, that our American version of the NHS fell apart. Oh.
Yes, this was Bill Clinton's big thing that he was pushing for when he got elected, which was the U.S. Health Security Act. This was going to be – the goal was universal coverage. It's not quite set up how the NHS is.
Yeah.
It was basically like the government will fully subsidize health insurance for, you know, people who are underemployed or unemployed or, you know, elderly, et cetera. And if you are working, we'll subsidize it for small businesses, but otherwise, you know, big companies, you have to pay 80% of these costs, et cetera. And it got lampooned to hell and back, much like the Affordable Care Act would be, you know, 15 years later, because it was a very large bill and Republicans really didn't like it.
Yeah, if there's anything that the GOP really loves, it's making sure that we do not give money to Americans to be healthy and instead spend that money on killing people in other countries.
But there is a, it's really there cool. is a game twist on this, because Maxis put out Sim Health, which was sort of a pseudo-simulation. It's not really a simulation of what it would, you know, what would be the outcomes of having different health systems. And that got them in some hot water with, you know, the political press, because they're like, oh, well, this is advocating for universal health care. And they're like, listen, it's not a real simulation, but yes, that's what it says.
I have a friend whose favorite game is Sim Health, and I used to just, like, ridicule that constantly, because it's the game that looks the most like just work. Like, it actually just looks like your screen if you were at work. And that fascinates me. And now I respect the man for having that as his favorite game. I've moved on. I've evolved. Well, but, yeah.
I think there's a great segue there, because while our government decided that we couldn't actually have healthcare, actually, they did decide that we needed to have more video game regulation, because the hearings, which began in late 1993, concluded in 1994, and by year's end, I guess the government didn't set this up, but the government leaned on the video game industry to create their own board, which is the ESRB, which started in late 1994. So we had a lot of discussion in the halls of Congress about what video games were going to be too violent for children to, or adults or anyone to see at the time, which is just really frustrating when you go back and watch these hearings, and it's, you know, you see executives throwing each other under the bus, and in the end it didn't really matter, because all that happened was, you know, we put some letters in front of the boxes and like, okay, great, so now it's okay, but
yes. I have to prove that I'm 18 to see penises in Baldur's Gate. Okay, yeah.
And, you know, the video game market was still kind of like, it was still very soft. This was during the, you know, not quite a crash, but kind of crash.
It was a recession, a video game recession.
Yes, that started in late 93, and it had a number of factors, like the technology behind video games was just changing really, really quickly. You know, 3D tech was coming into its own. Japan had a recession, but it also had a strong yen, so not only were companies there not making money internally, they weren't making money from foreign countries. So this was a bad time. It kept going for another, like, year or two.
Yeah, and it's funny you should say that, because if you look at the list of new consoles that debuted in 1994, they're basically all Japan exclusive for now. Several of them will come to America later and do quite well, and some of them will not come anywhere and they will do nothing. But, you know, 1994 is the year that the Saturn and PlayStation launch in Japan, all late 94. Yep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are pretty big. One's really big, but even the one that didn't do so well in America, pretty big console, and definitely, you know, big impact on the medium as a whole, I would say.
And then the Playdia and the PCFX came out too, and nobody wanted those, even in Japan.
So yes, 1994, as mentioned, this was a year that saw some movers and some shakers moving and shaking. This was kind of the very tail end of the early 90s and the general confusion around what the hell video game technology should even be. In 1994, it started to finally shake out. So you have things like the 3DO and the CDI and the Turbo CD and the Jaguar and so on and so forth, kind of shaking out. And in the end, one console would emerge standing tall, the Sony PlayStation, and there would be lots of other also-rans. But really, in 1994, you started to see those also-rans getting pruned, really, making way for a more sensible, I think, structure for the games industry. And whether, you know, you necessarily approve of how Sony has handled its dominance, the fact is things did become a lot saner and, you know, just kind of easier to follow once PlayStation sort of rose to become so prominent. So let's talk about some of the wild and woolly game systems debuting this year. Why don't we start with the best of the bunch? Kevin, tell us about the 32X.
I love the 32X. So this was something that U.S. retailers really wanted. It was sort of the baby of Sega of America. And the idea here for the 32X, which is an expansion for the Sega Genesis, is that it would provide a relatively low-cost upgrade for Genesis owners to, quote-unquote, catch up with how rapidly advancing, you know, video game technology had been moving circa 1994. I mean, there were several different variants of this that they sold at retail with different pack-in titles. So there was one with Doom, there was one with Star Wars Arcade, there was one with Virtua Fighter, and there's one that had Doom and a fighting game, Cosmic Carnage, which I do quite like. And the reasoning, I understand where they were coming from on this. The technology had shifted so much since the Genesis had come out, and since the Super NES had even come out. So, you know, wanting to fill that gap, I can see where you could make a financial argument for it. And the 32X hardware, like, it's extremely weird, but they put out some really, like, top-notch ports of Sega's arcade games. You know, you had some of the recent 3D stuff, Star Wars Arcade, Virtua Racing, Virtua Fighter. They didn't look as good as the arcade, but they looked really good. You had top-notch ports of Afterburner and Space Harrier, which is how I discovered Space Harrier, because my aunt had a 32X and I played a ton of it. And a lot of these, they actually tended to run better than the Saturn versions that came along like the following year, which to me is absolutely wild. But it never really had a lot of support from other developers, because, you know, it's a hardware expansion. That's splitting your market to, like, a really sad degree.
A second hardware expansion.
Yeah.
So the wild and cool thing about the 32X is that if you had a fully kitted out Sega Genesis, you had the Sega Genesis, you had the Sega CD, you had the 32X, which meant you had three different power adapters, three bricks plugged into your wall.
Yep.
And on top of that, the 32X, it didn't just take over the system. It was kind of like it sat on, not just physically on top of the system, but technically it was kind of like an overlay for the Genesis. So if you plug in a 32X and you don't have it hooked up right, you might see only the 32X graphics and not the Genesis graphics that are streaming in below. Or, you know, kind of like as an underlay.
Right, you've got to have that bus cable plugged in, which is just like a weird cable sticking out of one and into the other, even though they're connected in another place,
and that
too.
This has made the 32X really difficult to emulate and to recreate with modern technology. And I don't know if the Poly Mega can do it. I don't think it can. But the only way, you know, besides an emulator on a PC that you can do it that I know of is to take the analog Mega SG and plug in a 32X on top of it. And then you have to run the 32X, like you have to run it through a digital analog converter, or actually the Genesis signal through the digital analog converter, which then runs through the 32X, which then can only output through analog video. You can't do an HDMI connection from that. So you have to upscale it if you want to use it on modern systems. It's possible to do it if you have the right cable and the DAC, which is like a $100 component.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you know, you do all that, and then what do you get for it? You have
Calibri.
You
know,
Calibri's great. Shadow Squadron's great.
Calibri is not a great game. It's interesting.
It's
fun that they made a shooter out of a hummingbird. Tempo is Tempo's really cool. Cute. But it's also not actually that good. That's the thing is, like, I've played some of these games just out of curiosity. Like, these look great. I need to play them. Calibri, a hummingbird-based shooter, cool. And then you play them, and it's kind of like, oh, okay.
I feel like the library, even though it's small, it does kind of err on the side of quality, and the quality, like, is there. I think that it's sort of undeniably impressive what you're looking at, and there's a lot of sort of fascination tech-wise as well. But when you have got your your Sega CD and your Genesis and your 32X, and what you're able to do is play Corpse Killer, you ultimately have to be forced to concede it wasn't worth the money. But no, those arcade ports are really just crazily impressive. Like Afterburner, I'm not an expert, but like for me, that is like peak. It's so close to the arcade, if not identical, that I couldn't believe it was running on something that was powered by a Mega Drive, you know? Mm-hmm.
But we got Afterburner and Space Harrier, but not Outrun? That's kind of offensive to me personally.
That is odd, yeah.
You should have bought more 32Xs.
I remember seeing Cosmic Carnage on Games Master when I was a kid, and it's not maybe the greatest game ever, but it's one of those things where it's like, look how many colors we can fit on the screen. It's this incredibly garish kind of fighting game. But it stuck in my head because it was just so striking visually. And I want to say, while I've got an outlet to talk about the 32X, I think the Doom port gets a lot of stick it doesn't really deserve. I think that's quite impressive considering what they're working with. I mean, yes, the music sounds like farts, but like, just put a CD on.
That was my first exposure to Doom was the 32X port. And I'm like, this game is so cool.
Yeah.
And like, I had nothing to compare it to because it was 1994. Like, who's got a PC that can run Doom? Not that many people. I mean, probably more people than had a 32X, but.
Well, up on my hill of privilege, I was looking down my nose at you plebeians and playing real Doom.
I'll say for Cosmic Carnage, what makes it interesting to go back to is that most fighting games, when you block an attack, there's like a time where you can't do anything. You just have to like hold that. But not in Cosmic Carnage. You can cancel that block stun into anything, which makes for an extremely like aggressive and terrifying game. It's really fascinating. Also, the soundtrack is fantastic. Look it up.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the real downer for the 32X for me is the fact that, and I apologize if anyone here enjoys it, the air quote Sonic game for it is just a lump of odd shit. It's awful. It looks great, it sounds great, and the levels have nothing in them. They're just huge, empty, like, alpha look. Like, yeah. It's so bad.
Well, we all should have been tipped off that the game was called Sonic Ass. I mean, that was a good...
I just want to point out that I think it's very interesting that, you know, because the 32X flopped so hard that Sega basically had to change all their plans, I think. But apparently at one point they did announce and even show a picture of a sort of unified console that would just be like a hybrid 16-bit 32X, like in one machine without the sort of blocking thing together.
Was that the Neptune?
That was the Neptune.
Yeah.
Which I saw somebody started making, PCBs for, like, you could make your own Neptune.
Yes, Kevin, that's what I was getting to. I the other day on YouTube, I saw a video of a guy who's like, oh yeah, and now you can just get this thing. So, like, you can go online, you can get the parts you need, and I think you might need to, like, take apart your own Genesis to do so, but basically, with 3D printers or whatever, you can basically have your own version of that today if you're, you know, if you're willing to put in the time and invest in it. And that's just... That to me is impressive. I like that.
Yeah. Never underestimate Sega fans. They will move the earth to make these things happen.
It was an era of Frankensteinian hardware for Sega. A year from it. You have this, you have the Saturn, which is just a duct tape together piece of weirdness. And then they're like, oh, and also we'll cram the Genesis into a handheld. Like, what a weird, weird year for hardware design at Sega.
Jared, what I have discovered in my video project experiences is that Sega was always just bodging things together and doing weird stuff with their hardware. Like, from the fact that half of the library for the SG-1000 came on cards that could only be played with a card adapter.
Yeah.
Or by plugging it into a Mark III console, which got the colors wrong for all the software. there was no like all-in-one SG-1000 proper experience for playing those card games. So yeah, they just kind of made it up as they went along. And, you know, they were an arcade company first and foremost. So I think they were just like, well, you know, we put out new arcade hardware. The arcade owners are going to upgrade their systems. So clearly that works at home too, which is not the case. But, you know, you can kind of understand the philosophy there. But
that makes sense.
Yes, the 32X was kind of undermined by the fact that the same year that it came out, the Sega Saturn launched in Japan. So
wasn't the same month? Like, wasn't it all November, I think?
Might have been.
Yeah.
I did not actually put down the exact dates, but it was, not the best thought out plan. Definitely the era of two Segas not communicating with each other very clearly and jockeying for international dominance. Interestingly, according to Wikipedia, the best-selling game system of 1994 was not, shockingly, the 32X, or the Genesis, or the Super NES, or the Jaguar. It was the Game Boy.
Ooh.
And I supposedly, it had hardware sales of 7.5 million units. Even though this was kind of the Game Boy on decline, like at this point it was 5 years old and was woefully underpowered compared to anything in the market at this point. Sega's Nomad was out now, or was coming out soon after. You just had all these other platforms, portable and consoles, that just made Game Boy look kind of sad, but it just kept plugging away with some pretty good games, and everyone just sort of took it for granted. But I think part of that was buoyed by the fact that the Super Game Boy came out that year.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all of a sudden you could see what you were playing on your Game Boy, and that was really cool. Like, wow, all of a sudden I can actually identify the objects on screen, and I can see all the little bullets flying at me, and I don't have to worry about, you know, the bleed and the brightness and the lack of lighting. I can just play these games and enjoy them. Mm-hmm. And so that was actually where I first really got into Game Boy was, I'd played the portable system some, you know, that belonged to other people. But once I got my Super Game Boy, then all of a sudden I kind of went into Game Boy cartridge acquisition mode, which, you know, meant going to used record shops and things like that and just finding whatever cartridges I could for $15 or $20 and, you know, stuff like Metroid 2 and Final Fantasy Legend and so forth, Zelda. It was good times. So I guess if you're counting Super Game Boy as Game Boy hardware, I can understand how it definitely, you know, topped the sales charts.
Yeah, I can see. I mean, Super Game Boy, even taking that aside, there were quite a few. I mean, stuff like Donkey Kong Land, I think, was out this year. I could be wrong on that.
No, Donkey Kong Land was not, but Donkey Kong Game Boy for the 94 game.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, actually, you signed up to talk about. Do you want to talk about that?
I wouldn't mind if you're not, but I don't want to talk over the Super Game Boy, of course. I first played the Super Game Boy this year for the first time in my life, and it left me with an unquenchable urge to get one, because I was just that, I enjoyed it so much. It was just such a pleasure to play Kirby on that thing. But yeah, Donkey Kong, what is sometimes called Donkey Kong 94, I think probably erroneously. I don't want to say stuff that everyone listening to this already knows, but it's probably the best Game Boy game, or at least it's in the contention, I would say, as this remake or port of Donkey Kong that maybe initially seems kind of old hat, but then just blows the roof off once you beat Donkey Kong for the first time. And of course, once you know all the tricks the game teaches you, when you do those initial stages, you can just backflip your way up the girders and completely break it, which is very fun to do. But basically, Donkey Kong Game Boy is this not single screens, it's occasionally scrolling platform game where you need to collect a key and then take it to the doorway to rescue, I don't know which princess it is, Pauline in Donkey Kong?
She's a mayor, not a princess.
Excuse me, mayoress. Pauline.
She's an elected official as opposed to, you know, selected by the divine right of kings.
She might be on city council at this point. We're not sure.
Okay, I respect Pauline a little more than I respect Peach in that respect, then. But basically, what the game does that I find the most fascinating about it, other than the level design being just, like, tremendous the whole way through, like, is there are, like, a couple of frustrating levels, but you'd expect that from a game like this. What gets me is that you, every few levels, you'll get a little cutscene, and every time you get that little cutscene, it will teach you something new you can do in the game. And you've got two buttons, one of which is kind of a nothing button, and the D-pad, and you've got probably, like, more moves than Mario 64 in there. I mean, in fact, there's probably transferred over to Mario 64 some of these moves. Yeah,
absolutely.
They probably about it. But it means you can, when you replay it with all the skills that you've learned, you can get better times, you can get better scores, you can really rinse the game, because you're not going to run out of lives, because it's just kind of throwing them in your face the whole time, like almost any Nintendo game. But the fact that a game just keeps going and going and going and going and going and going and never stops being fresh, like, ever. There is no point where you're just like, I'm kind of bored of this, I'm kind of over this now. You want to get to the end, and you want to get to that final boss, and when you do, it delivers, like, completely. It's probably the most complete experience I can think of on the Game Boy. Others may disagree, and they have every right to do so, but if someone said to you, this is the best Game Boy game, it would be difficult, I think, to argue with them in terms of what it offers and what it, I mean, are there even any missteps? I can't think of a single one. You've got the battery backup in there. It's a perfect game.
Yeah, it's the most ridiculously overscoped game I can think of. So no one was asking for this. Like, the design team could have just made four Donkey Kong levels and shipped Donkey Kong on the Game Boy, and they would have been fine. And they're like, no, we'll just make a 100-level Mario puzzle platforming masterpiece that's infinitely replayable, and no one knows, and then we'll just kind of hide it behind this box.
It's definitely a game that it was designed around expectations, and, you know, part of its brilliance is in subverting that. And so if you pick it up in 1994, you've seen lots of ports of NES and arcade games that are just like, hey, here's a monochromatic version of, say, Pac-Man, you know? Uh-huh. Like, it's just Pac-Man. So you assume, oh, okay, well, yeah, I love Donkey Kong, and I'm feeling a little nostalgic for it. I want to pick it up and play it. And so you pick it up and play it, and it just seems like Donkey Kong. And then it slowly reveals itself to be so much more. A big part of its impact is just, you know, that initial expectation and or lack of expectation, really. And the fact that the more you play, the more it's like, oh, wait, hang on, here's more. Oh, actually, yes, actually, there's even more than that. And it's just, it's very generous. It's a very generous game.
I find it, sorry.
I was going to say, do you think the way they approach Donkey Kong Jr. in this game, which is like the last time he's ever been relevant, informed how they decided to, you know, bring in Bowser Jr. in Mario Sunshine? Because he fulfills sort of the same role. He's like the head lackey for Donkey Kong, and he's like a boss for certain parts of the game.
I'd forgotten completely that he was in it. It's been a while since I played it, and as soon as you mentioned it, it's like, oh yeah, that entire aspect of the game that I'd completely forgotten about. I think a testament to this is that every time that they tried to recreate it, they completely screwed it up. I mean, Mario vs. Donkey Kong is the closest thing to this, getting a remake next year on the Switch. And, you know, it's fine, but it has none of the charm at all of this, because they just couldn't recreate it, which I guess is why that series went off in such a different direction, because they realized, now we can't do this, we can't do the same thing, we can't capture lightning in a bottle twice like this. And, you know, there's never been anything as good as this before or since, really, in terms of Donkey Kong. And that part of me wonders if it was kind of a flex of just like, well, yeah, everyone's mad about this 3D rendered Donkey Kong Country stuff, but this is a real Donkey Kong game. I don't know.
I doubt it.
I mean, it's better than Donkey Kong Country. And I love Donkey Kong Country, you know?
Which also came out in 1994, but no one signed up to talk about it. So let's move on to something completely different. Yeah, right. Well, let's move on to something completely different. Diamond, what the hell is Dr. Hauser? Is that like Doogie?
No, it's what's his name from Fry and Laurie.
I wouldn't be surprised if they took some inspiration there, but no, Dr. Hauser to me is a fascinating creation. It actually debuted on the 3DO, and it's a fully 3D, I guess, prototypical survival horror game. It's kind of more of an adventure game, but it's like you're in a house and you're exploring the space and you're looking for Dr. Hauser. You don't know where he is, and you know you can get killed. Not really like monsters, but there are hazards that can kill you. And it's all running in full 3D on a console, which is like, this is pretty early for that. I mean, I think it comes out in the spring of 94, so like even before the PlayStation or Saturn exists. And yeah, of course, if you look at it today, you know, the frame rate is atrocious and the graphics are really, really simplistic, but it's still a really interesting game to look at. And, you know, if you can get it running, I would say give it a try. I know it has different camera angles you can cycle through, and the house is full of, you know, mysteries, and it's I'm sure someone has created an English patch for it by now. There must be an English patch for it now.
There is.
It's too significant to not be patched by this point. But or you can watch people like, I know Retro Pals has played it, but yeah, it's the kind of game that I never heard of until many years later, and then I think because it was on 3DO, it didn't do so great. But I think anyone who played it in Japan, who also had, you know, was involved in making games, they all looked at this and said, oh, wow, we can do this. And I think they really took this as sort of a challenge. Like, oh, we can do more from this. And I don't know how directly it might have impacted Resident Evil. I think it might have made them think about doing all 3D and then decided, oh, no, we can't do that yet. But in any case, you can certainly see some crossover potential there, or at least with D. D also kind of has a lot, you know, you're walking around a house, but yeah, it's not the kind of game I can recommend playing very easily because it's hard to actually acquire, but it to me is fascinating, and I love watching people play it and try and figure it out.
Interesting. That doesn't sound like my jam at all, but I'm
pretty intrigued.
That it excites you. Okay, so Jared, tell us about Pac-Man 2. That was the game from 1994 that you said, I want to talk about this.
Yeah. I was going to talk about Umehara Kawase, but I wasn't there for it in 94. That came much later. So Pac-Man 94 was, boy, that was a surprise. You get Pac-Man 2, and you're expecting maybe something Pac-Mania-ish or maybe Pac-Land-ish. What you don't expect is the prequel to The Last Guardian. A game about yelling at your dog and it not doing what you want. Pac-Man 2 is a side-scrolling, beautifully animated adventure game where you don't have direct control of Pac-Man, but you have to make him do things anyway. And you accomplish this by prodding him with a slingshot. You shoot things on the screen to try to draw his attention to them. You shoot him when you're mad at him. And depending on the mood and the events that have triggered the game, the Pac-Man's in at any one moment, he may or may not do what you want, and you solve puzzles with him. It's kind of like a LucasArts game with all like the really, it's a very beautiful game. All the gorgeous, gorgeous layered backgrounds and foregrounds and really pretty animated characters and lavish color palette, especially for low resolution like you have on a console. It's really impressive compared to what you have on PC. But taking that and then adding an extra layer of frustration to the already esoteric format, it is the kind of game that I play and I'm like, what the fuck were they thinking? Why does this exist? But it's not in the, boy, I never want to play this way. It's in the, man, I can't wait to see what happens next way because it's so bizarre. I just want to keep going. And Pac-Man has some weird stuff go on during his day, man. Like, Pac-Man has some strange days. His day-to-day life and the tasks he accomplishes when he goes out from his house before he comes back to his little family. I don't know if that's Ms. Pac-Man or Pac-Mom or what that's hanging out at home there. I know they've like retconned that. But Pac-Man 2, a game worth experiencing today, if you never have, because it's so, so weird.
I love this
game. It was on Wii U, I think, Virtual Console, and that's the last time it was like officially available. But I discovered this one going through a pack of SNES ROMs when I was a kid. And I'm like, oh, Pac-Man. As you say, I was like, oh, Pac-Man 2, this will be a maze game. And you're like, huh? Why am I playing, like, dogs crossed with lemmings crossed with, like, Monkey Island? What the hell's going on? I absolutely loved this, and I got obsessed with it because it's like, you really need to finish it. You know, you want to know all the mad shit that's going to happen next. You want to see Pac-Man's mood change and his absolutely demented expressions that he pulls when he's really happy or when he's really sad. They like reanimate his whole walk cycle so he's like depressed or he's like jovially walking along with this huge mouth, like big pack smiley mouth. And they do integrate sort of the old games in. I think there's some arcade machines you can play, like put versions of like some of the old games on. And there is some, oh yeah, he turned into like Super Pac-Man and he can like fly around and eat the ghosts and sort of, if you shoot a power pill at him. I'd forgotten all about that. And yeah, the whole thing is just bonkers. Like you have to play it. It's so bizarre that they called this Pac-Man 2. I mean, Pac-Man was in a weird space at this time, but still.
Stu, it's funny you mentioned the expressions, because this is also the game that, you know, the Pac-Man 2, which is only the English title, by the way. In Japan, it's called Hello Pac-Man. But, you know, the international box art also has this sort of unhinged drawing of Pac-Man on a hand glider. And he's making this face, which is sort of, I guess it's the face, it's kind of like the Road Warrior face, like, or not, or Mad Max face before the people, like, hit the car and, like, you know, explode. It's like he's terrified of what's happening to him.
It makes me wonder if maybe there was some Western sort of Ren and Stimpy slash Animaniacs, that kind of thing, sort of influence. You know, the more bigger takes, the bigger kind of cartoons like that.
It does strike me of something that, like, they looked at Looney Tunes or Tom and Jerry and pulled from that.
They certainly didn't look at the Hanna-Barbera Pac-Man cartoon. Cause it's not...
Yeah, I loved this game. I rented it all the time. It's so good.
All right, so I need to push us on through so we can actually finish this episode. So, Kevin, you have two items that you've selected. Pick one and tell us about it. Which is it going to be? What stands out the most to you in the year 1994?
Let's get interesting. We'll talk about the Cotton games here. Cotton 100% for the Super Famicom and Panorama Cotton for the Mega Drive. These were both sequels to the arcade game Cotton, you know, Fantasy Night Cotton. I forget what the full...
Fantastic Night Dreams.
Fantastic like Night Dreams Cotton, yes, yeah. Thank you. Which was a really weird, cute style shooter where you're like a little witch on a broom and you're hanging out with fairies and you're shooting enemies to try and collect magical candies. The fairies need them for something and she just wants to eat them. So you're playing, you know, not quite a villain, but you're like a reluctant hero that you're only doing this for your own gain. So Cotton was fairly popular. They ported it to the PC Engine CD. Eventually it got ports to like the PlayStation and the Neo Geo Pocket. But at this point they were looking to port it to the Super Famicom, and early in production they realized, hey, we could just do something a little different. So this is sort of like a remix, Cotton 100% of the original. So like the stages are more colorful and they've shifted things around. So that's a new experience, but it plays more or less the same. So if you're interested in Cotton, you can try that one out. And Panorama Cotton, they took a completely different approach. This is like a Space Harrier game. So you're behind Cotton and you're sort of flying around this rail shooter space, dealing with enemies. She's also after candy again in this one, as is her way. But, this is really impressive. This is probably the best, like, Space Harrier style game short of the 32X or like the X68000. It's really cool. It's exceptionally rare, although I believe both of these have had digital reissues or are about to have digital reissues.
They're on Switch. I think they're at, like I said, a very bare bones courts, but they are there, so that's nice.
They are very cool. I highly recommend checking them out.
Yeah, Panorama Cotton for me is one of those things where you look at it and you're just like, I can't believe this is running on the hardware that it's running on. It's insane how impressive it is.
It's ridiculous. I was deeply impressed the first time I tried this out, because I'd heard about it for years before I tried it, and I'm like, that might be good. Space Harrier 2 kind of sucked, but holy crap.
I bought it just before it got expensive, played it a great deal, and then sold it at exactly the right or wrong moment. Pardon me.
That was a story that started happy and ended sad.
So we really are running out of time. So rather than me tell you about Super Metroid or the Lunar games again, Lunar Eternal Blue, I'm going to just kind of give a rundown of some of the games, the notable games of 1994, so you can see how overloaded this year was with great games. You had Wario's Woods and Adventure Island 4, which were the final NES and Famicom games ever published legitimately under Nintendo license. There were two Donkey Kong games after years of silence. There were, how many is this? Four Sonic games, Sonic 3, Sonic 3 and Knuckles, Sonic Drift, and Sonic Triple Trouble.
3 and Knuckles is the only one that really matters there.
Earthbound Gym. Earthworm Jim. Earthbound Jim. Someone please make that crossover for me. Final Fantasy 6, a.k.a. Final Fantasy 3, my God. Era of the Acrobat 2.
Disappointing sequel. Not as good as the first one.
You could read all about it in Stuart's book. All things are good. On sale now. Alien vs. Predator. There's two of those, actually. There's the arcade one and the console one, which are both totally different games.
The console was the Jaguar first-person game, right?
Correct.
That was really huge back in the day, yeah.
The arcade one is the Capcom Brawler, where you get to play as Arnold Schwarzenegger and not appearing in the movie, Lin Kurosawa.
Also kicks ass.
Yes.
She's cool, but she's not in the movie. I guess they couldn't get Sigourney Weaver's likeness in there.
If you want to play that one at home, you've got to buy a big Capcom logo with some buttons on it.
Or not. Breath of Fire 2, Bubsy 2, Castlevania Bloodlines, Konami finally giving Genesis fans a little love. And Contra Hardcore also, a lot of love, actually.
Couple of really badass games there.
And there's Tournament Fighters, TMNT. So that's their Led Zeppelin moment for Genesis. A whole lot of love. Demon's Crest, Clockwork Knight over on Saturn. Yeah. Geograph Seal on the X68000, the precursor to Jump and Flash. Kasumi Ninja, Kirby's Dream Course.
Yep, still play that to this day on multiplayer with friends. I love that game to death.
The best golf game, actually.
Second best after NES Open Tournament, but, dream on.
Kingsfield, the prequel to Elden Ring or whatever, Elder Scrolls. One of those FromSoft games. Live Alive, recently remade for Nintendo Switch and other systems, I think.
Very well.
Definitely
very well
for Switch.
Delightful game.
So many Mega Mans. There's Mega Man 5 with a V, because it's for Game Boy. X2 with an... I just got balloons on Zoom. That was... If you give the victory the V, it sends up balloons on Zoom. That's really weird. Okay.
That's terrifying.
You can't see that. Yeah.
Are we all trying it now?
Ah, there we go. Yep. This is completely useless for anyone listening to this episode. Stupid technology.
I think it only works if your name is Jeremy.
Mega Man V, Mega Man X2. But that's not 10-2, it's X2. It's very confusing. Some Roman numerals, some not. Mega Man Soccer, and over throwing a bone to the Genesis fans, Wily Wars.
Only on Sega Channel.
Yes, the Ignition Factor for those of you who, like, really expensive Super NES games that no one bought.
Is that like a firefighting game? That sounds awesome.
It is, yes. Magic Carpet.
Yes, Magic Carpet.
The song that...
Steppenwolf?
Yes. I was going to make a joke about...
Is that from Cochrane launching his spaceship?
Yes, thank you. God, I couldn't remember his name. I wanted to say Jeffries, but no, it's the other one.
We're a couple of years out from that.
Yep. Got to get through the post-atomic horror first. Yes. Mutant League Hockey, Speaking of post-atomic horror, Pitfall: The Mayan Adventure. We recently discussed this in an episode, so no need to belabor the point. Pocky and Rocky 2, maybe the most expensive game on this list, and it's a list that has Earthbound on it. That's telling us something about Pocky and Rocky 2.
It's a list that has Pulse Man on it.
Pulse Man? Is that also expensive now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, Shaq Fu, not expensive. Streets of Rage 3, Shin Megami Tensei 2, Super 3D Noah's Ark, for those of you who want Doom at home.
That's Wolfenstein at home.
That's Wolfenstein, right. Okay, we have Wolfenstein at home. Super Punch-Out, Tempest 2000, Jeff Minter finally discovering how to drop acid and share the experience with the world. Yep. Tokimeki Memorial, Umihara Kawase.
Yay.
Uniracers, the game that was banned by Pixar for apparently looking like Lampo the Lamp or whatever.
I hate Pixar now.
Yeah, they're the worst. They used to be really cool, not anymore. Wario Land for Game Boy. That's why the Game Boy was the best-selling game of the system of the year. It had Wario Land. And Zero the Kamikaze Squirrel.
Oh. Genuinely good game, and I will stand for it any day.
It's just the themes. The themes are really,
Kamikaze Squirrel, not great, is it? Like,
no,
it's not ideal.
Actually, no. The opposite of great.
There's a degree to which it could be described as horrifically racist.
Yes, that's the one. Anyway, so that was the console space. There was a lot happening in arcades, and we're just going to blast past it because most of it is kind of like the final gasp of fighting games before they started to, I don't know, like the next year you got Killer Instinct, and that was kind of the end of the show.
The Outfoxy next year.
It was, but that was more of a Smash Brothers kind of thing.
I know, but that's what made it great.
A proper fighting game.
Oh, I played so much Outfoxies.
Here are all the fighting games that I cared to write down. Not all of them, just the ones I cared to write down. Tekken, which is actually, that's very important. Tekken, it's people like it for some reason. Killer Instinct. Oh, I guess that was this year. So that's the end. Okay. King of Fighters 94. So in some ways, the beginning and the end all in one. Fight, do you want to tell us why King of Fighters 94 is the beginning of all things good? Like the reason to exist on the planet?
Well, I just think it's, we're living today in a media saturated environment where everyone, they're willing to give up a testicle to get a shared universe of characters together.
I actually am not.
I am, but not one of mine.
These do not speak for me.
And, 30 years ago, SNK said, okay, well, we have these Fatal Fury games. These are successful. We have Art of Fighting, which, some people love. And we've also been making video games for about 15 years at this point. What if we put them all together? What if we decide it's all canon, it's all happening, and they make this game, King of Fighters 94, which is not only this sort of amazing conglomeration of various ideas they've had around the office, but also some really interesting original characters, and also the fact that for the next 10 years, basically, they commit to making a new version every year. Every year they make it, like, if they call King for 94, because guess what? This is going to be 95 and 96 and 97, 98. They're going to keep going. And only when the company basically dies, do they say, you know what? Maybe we have to slow down a little bit.
And even then, it took them a couple of years.
Yeah, they kept, 2003, they kept the annual, they kept doing annual stuff. And then after that, like, okay, let's just do 11, I guess. So, yeah, but it's a, it's an amazing game, and certainly if you were into fighting at the time, it was kind of the preview, because honestly, we play all this, it's like, oh geez, so when are these characters going to fight the Street Fighter characters? And that would take a few more years, but still, it was kind of like it was a big turning point where we realized, oh geez, anything's possible. Black can be white, and cats can love dogs. It's all possible in the future.
So that was the beginning of King of Fighters, but that wasn't all that SNK had for the world. Kevin, tell us about Samshou 2.
Yeah, so 1994, towards the end of the year, SNK put together Samurai Showdown 2, which was the sequel to the previous year's Samurai Showdown. So this was a huge hit for SNK. I think this might have been their most successful fighting game in the United States. It's certainly the one that I've come across people who were around at the time. It's the one they remember best out of all of these that they put out.
Well, I would say stylistically, so like it drew like a moth to the flame. The art and the smoothness didn't look like other fighting games. Even Samurai Showdown 1 didn't have this sense of contrast, I think, to the character and background art. It just, I remember at the time thinking it was the best looking video game in arcades. Keep going, but they, I want to confirm, like I could not stay away from this machine.
It's so moody. It's incredible. Like,
yeah.
All of these stages, and not all of them have, like, these full soundtracks. Some of them just have, like, very, like, understated, you know, there's a couple instruments, there might be someone chanting, or you might just, like, hear the wind on top of that. I remember, you know, especially Genjiro's stage. This is where they introduced Genjiro, who was sort of the rival character for the rest of the series. They introduced Seeger in this one, who didn't really show up again, but he was really cool.
Yeah. I'll go ahead, Diamond.
I just, you know, Samurai Showdown was a really strong debut and it had a lot of great things going for it, but they really cranked out an incredible expansion, which also, for the record, in Japanese, this is not called 2, it's basically called Shin Samurai Showdown, or Samurai Spirits, of course, but it sort of expanded that game and, they replaced one character with another character and they created a bunch of new characters and they really go all out, like, okay, what the hell could we put in this thing? What if we make a giant German man who's just got a big glove? You know what I mean? Like, this, you know, this series, the first game is mostly swords. It's mostly swords. You know, there's some other weapons in there, but it's mostly about people with swords, mostly men, some women. But Samurai Showdown 2 is like, no. We got staves, we got spears, we got clubs, we got a big rock, and this guy, he just got a big old glove, but like he can load a bullet into it and like flick you in the face with it. Like, it doesn't make any sense, but cool. My God, that I love playing Seeger. I love it. He can grab you. He can throw you. He can just punch shoot you. It's, oh geez.
Yeah, I was just trying to get edgy and anime at this point, and this fulfilled all my dreams and wishes. Like, it felt like every videotape that I'd borrowed from someone that I probably shouldn't have been watching at that age, and just the marvelous sense of ultra violence and style and blood. I do think this was the first great weapons fighter. I can't think of another. And it was also deeply intuitive. You didn't have to be good at fighting games to feel like you were accomplishing something in Samurai Showdown 2, unless you were playing somebody who was really good. And that was nice too. It was very, very approachable. It had the honor. I know it was popular enough that it transcended my arcade and it became the one machine at the Pizza Hut. And that was always in my town a sign that a game was really popular. If it was popular enough that the Pizza Hut kept it, then you knew people were playing it. And there were always people gathered around reading that ridiculous mistranslated intro.
Yeah. One of the more infamous SNK localizations, for sure.
Yeah, I remember, like, around 2002, a friend of mine, he was running tournaments, and the arcade he was running them at had a Neo Geo machine, and he asked them, like, hey, can I pop in, like, Samurai Showdown 2 and KOF 98 for my event, because I have the MVS cards? And they're like, sure, whatever, do that. And they were so popular, like, having them back in there, that the arcade asked him if they could just keep them in there for, like, I don't know, they were there for, like, 6 months or so.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had long legs, these games, especially Sam Show 2.
We were so washed over with fighting games after Street Fighter 2 that I think maybe in retrospect, sometimes we forget that a few of them really did stand out, not just for fighting game people, but, you know, the narrative is they all became about fighting game people and it sort of became its own niche market. But there was a period where there were a few standouts that everybody enjoyed. And I do think that this is one of those few rare games that was just everybody who liked video games played this if they went to an arcade.
So, Jared, I can't believe you totally dissed Weapon Lord like that. The first
weapon-based
fighting game.
Weapon-based fighting game.
You're correct.
Yeah.
There were lots and lots of other fighting games in 1994. I think I mentioned Tekken, Killer Instinct. There was Primal Rage.
Yes.
better than you think.
Didn't that have like a giant monkey that peed on you as a killing move?
That's exactly what I was going to mention.
Yeah, okay.
If nothing else, it has a big monkey that pisses acid, which is perfect.
Yeah, fucking video game.
If we're talking about fighting games, you know, the Mortal Kombat 2 came out at the end of 93, so we were definitely still playing a lot of Mortal Kombat 2 in 1984.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we were also seeing a lot of Mortal Kombat clones at this point, and that was, Primal Rage is definitely one of the more interesting takes on the Mortal Kombat formula, because instead of photographed actors, they're basically little stop-motion dinosaurs and giant apes, and it's all violent and it's all gory, and there are finishing moves, and the control system, like the inputs you actually do to moves is really bizarre. It's like, instead of doing a joystick motion and pushing a button, you're holding a button and then doing joystick motions. Like, it really doesn't really make sense, but we certainly played a lot of it at the time. And it's like, I know there was a sequel at some point, and then the whole thing kind of just disappeared. But for a while there, it seemed like it was going to be something bigger than it turned out to be.
Yeah, the sequel
didn't have dreams.
I was going to say, the sequel didn't actually even come out, but there is a prototype cabinet at the Galloping Ghost. You can check it out. And
all right, there it was. Yeah,
I'll add Primal Rage is like probably the only game on this list that is not like emulated very well, because it had some weird security code that has not yet been cracked. So really, the only way to experience it properly is the arcade cabinet, as it turns out.
So also in 1994. Capcom continued to, as the joke goes, prove their inability to counter the number 3. They think that after 2, you get Super Turbo and X. No, X is way after 2. That's Roman numeral 10. We already went through this with Mega Man. But to their credit, Capcom was doing a lot of other really cool stuff at the time, including Saturday Night Slam Masters 2.
Yes.
Cyberbots, which involves robots and stuff. That's wild.
I like
Darkstalkers, the Night Warriors. And finally, going just for the popular appeal of the era, X-Men, Children of the Atom, which would eventually blossom into Marvel versus Capcom.
I can't believe all of these were the same year. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They kind of overdid it, I think. And then you even had weird stuff like Aggressors of Dark Combat, where the developer ADK said, what does our name stand for? It's Aggressors of Dark Combat. But they didn't know until Mortal Kombat came out, and they realized, combat is spelled with a K.
Also
Golden Axe the Duel, Sega's last gasp for relevance for that franchise until many years later.
There's your weapon fighter,
where
Jeremy.
They said, yeah, they were like, well, what if Golden Axe were a fighting game? And no one liked this, as the caption says.
Saturn port.
So that was
bad.
That was the fighting aspect of the arcade. But also in arcades, you had all kinds of other stuff happening. Some were like holdovers from the olden times, like my personal favorite, Elevator Action 2, which feels very much like a throwback, even in 1994. But it's so good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You had
that game's great.
Windjammers, the famous basically Ultimate Frisbee video game. You had Gokujo Parodius. That's
chatting
the chatting.
Yeah.
I think that's chatting Parodius.
Something like that.
You still had some of those pre-fighting game walk and punch type games, but elevated literally with a Tower of Doom, Dungeons and Dragons. Capcom said, what if we put like a proper leveling system and consistency in here?
This is great. The essay that leads to Shadow over Mysterio, which is the real masterpiece. Like this is laying the groundwork for one of the great all time brawlers.
So I have to pop out actually.
Yeah,
it's time.
Kevin, I know you have to take off. Why don't you give us your bona fides so people can find you on the internet, and we will continue without you.
So you can find me online at Ubersaurus on Twitter and Blue Sky, and you can find my work under Atari Archive on YouTube and in a book that is available now. And thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, and I hope everything goes well for you. We'll get you next time you're on the show, by definition.
Yeah, all the best, Kevin.
Bye, Kevin.
All right, so also some holdovers from the olden times. You had Jurassic Park, the last great, actually maybe the last Superscalar game. Just absolutely bonkers, super cool. You had another brawler type game with Alien vs. Predator, which I mentioned before. You had a few classic sprite-based top-down shooters like Gunbird and Raiden DX. Then you had the cool innovation of polygons in a racing game with, let's see, what was there? Sega Rally, Cruisin' USA, Daytona USA, a lot of America Racing, all in polygons. At the same time, you had Puzzle Bobble, which feels like a game that is much, much older, but this is just the beginning of its reign, kind of like King of Fighters 94. You'd think, oh, this is from a time long before that, but it wasn't. It was from here, and it just kept going. That Neo Geo, what a wild piece of hardware.
Prequel to Snood.
Oh, yes.
Oh, God, fucking Snood. Sorry. That's
And then you had Blomby Car.
Blomby Car.
Blomby Car. I don't know what that is, but it's got a name. It came out in 94. No, it's like an isometric racing game. It looks really, really dated for 1994, but it's called Blomby Car, so I'm going to give it a pass regardless.
Yeah, fair. It sounds like a Spectrum game, to be honest.
It does, yes. It looks a little better than a Spectrum game, not a lot. Anyway, so arcades, they were kind of a transitional state. You were either playing fighting games, or you were playing like weird holdovers, or you were dipping your toes into polygons. Meanwhile, on computers, actually, you know, most of these games weren't even polygon-based yet. TIE Fighter, basically, that was it. Everything else was still kind of 2.5D and so on and so forth. So let's talk about cool stuff that happened on home computers. Mostly, you had Doom clones, just as they weren't first-person shooters yet. Just as the arcade was heavily dominated by fighting games, the home computer gaming scene was heavily dominated by Doom-alikes. So the game that was most like Doom was, in fact, Doom 2. Stuart, tell us about it.
Well, I talked about this with Diamond and David Craddock on the Doom Clones episode relatively recently, so I'll keep it as brief as I can. But for me, Doom 2 is like one of those games where it's like, this is really, really good, and also it's not as good as the game it was inspired by, because it's just a much more open, much bigger stages. And there's something about it that to me feels less focused, like just kind of pushed out. But at the same time, it's got the super shotgun. It's got a much bigger bestiary with some really, really cool monsters. And, you know, the level design is pretty great. It's just, it leans a little bit more on, like, engine tricks than I think the original game does, in a way that sometimes makes it feel like you just need to keep quick saving, because you're moving over, like, for example, very thin pits over balance beams over, like, toxic pits that just kill you. And weird little tricks and traps stages, like the level that's actually named Tricks and Traps, where it's like, look what we can do with this engine now. And, you know, it's great. It's not as pure, but it's still incredible. And it pretty much deserves the acclaim that it gets.
Yeah.
I'm just one of those purists who makes sure that every time it comes up, I say, well, it's not as good as Doom.
It's a great game.
But you know what was as good as Doom? Was System Shock. Jared Petty, tell us about it.
Yeah, System Shock, which it's a Doom clone in probably the farthest from all of these from actually being like Doom. It's got more in common in a lot of ways. I think it's more Half-Life Zero than Doom 2. System Shock has the trappings of a first-person shooter and some of the mechanics, but it also functions very much like an adventure game or an RPG. It's got a lot of Ultima Underworld vibe in its DNA. It is a story-driven, environment interaction-driven spooky space shooter. System Shock sets, of course, the ground for much more frightening games to come in the wonderfully enigmatic System Shock 2 and in BioShock, etc., and all the other shocks to come. But it even on its own, it's a small contained game with a great villain. Shodan is genuinely frightening, a little disconcerting. I think this is one of the first video game examples of kind of a you versus GLaDOS thing going on, which is a lot of later games draw from, the evil AI on one end, you on the other, in a lonely place. System Shock was recently remade by Night Dive, and cannot recommend it enough. This is a game that holds up far, far better than you imagine. And I know we say that on Retronauts a lot, speaking to a retro audience, but System Shock I would recommend to people who like video games in general, whether they listen to the show or not. The remake really is worth checking out.
Can I just note real quick that there's also the System Shock remaster that they put out, which if you want a more sort of pure experience, it's like that, but with some of the nastier, grubbier edges kind of filed off, so it plays a bit more contemporary while not losing any of the functionality or visuals. But the remake is amazing, so that is an option.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then directly in between Doom 2 and System Shock, you have Marathon,
yes,
the actual shooter, not the multiplayer extraction-based shooter.
It's never coming
that
out.
That may or may not come out at some point in the future. Anyway, the original Marathon was a Macintosh exclusive until the Bandai Pippin Atmark came along, and we got Super Marathon that may or may not actually have come out as a retail product. Marathon was it's a Doom-style shooter, but, you know, added some technological innovations to it, but also very heavily story-focused, which also involved an artificial intelligence that wanted to kill you and do stuff, bad stuff. But eventually the AI decides that I don't want to kill you. I actually want you to be my little puppet running around doing stuff for me. And so the story goes in some interesting directions. There are friendly and hostile NPCs. There are, you know, kind of like in Doom, you have sort of the different race systems where certain enemies will turn against each other. You have cool weapons. This was, I believe, the game that invented grenade jumping, where you could fire a grenade at your feet and it would explosively propel you upward so you could reach places you weren't supposed to go. It was really big on land-based multiplayer, had a lot of interesting modes, which carried on through into games like Halo, and just was generally pretty cool. A good quality shooter that Mac users were pretty insufferable about. I can say that as someone who was a Mac user and was honestly, probably insufferable about it.
I think they had the right to be, honestly. It was that good. It was very, very impressive Doom, yeah, as
yes,
the Doom Clones go.
I mean, I think Marathon and its sequels are phenomenal games, truly top of their class, but that was pretty much all there was on Mac. So, you know, it's a little bit like the Chihuahua barking a bit too loud to try to scare off the big dogs.
I want to say we had an LC3 in our high school that somebody had put Marathon on. And
I had an LC3, and that was not a great experience.
Yeah, but it was a blessing compared to, you know, work at school. You know,
that's true. You get that little 200 by 150 pixel window,
didn't run
surrounded
very well.
By a bunch of stuff. Yeah, good times. Anyway, Marathon, very cool. So there were some games on PCs that did not want to be Doom. And there were some pretty major franchises that kicked off here. Warcraft, XCOM. Okay, those are the only two that kicked off. Oh, no, Elder Scrolls Arena. Wow. So some pretty big, long-running franchises got their beginning on PC in 1994. And you also had continuations of other series, including both TIE Fighter, the sequel to X-Wing, and Wing Commander 3, the sequel to Wing Commander 2.
Weirdly, Mark Hamill, not in the TIE Fighter game, but in Wing Commander 3.
Well, I mean, why would Mark Hamill be in a TIE Fighter game anyway?
That's
Luke Skywalker was not a TIE Fighter pilot. He would have been the little guy you shoot down. And you can't kill Luke Skywalker in a game where you play as the Empire. That's just, like, that's not canon right there. This is, you know, just off. It's like the Bad Batch or something. It has
you're
nothing to do with the main
so
story.
Many business meetings I was in right now.
Oh, are you allowed to talk about them?
Probably not any more than this, no.
Okay. Well, I do want to give a shout out to Zork Anthology, which is just, it was a collection of Zork text adventures. But, you know, in 1994, that was kind of cool. It's like, hey, here's something from 15 years ago. It's only text, but we're selling it as a packaged product with, you know, like a book and stuff, some maps, and just, it was a rare instance of, at this point, of publishers presenting video game heritage as something good and notable and worthwhile, like something that still had actual value, not just as a product or as a free download, but as a thing you could own and re-experience. And that was great. It gave me a lot of respect for the Zork series. I also want to mention Systems Twilight, which was another Mac exclusive game that not enough Mac users are insufferable about, but was a very cool, I think it was a shareware game, but it was very like, it just felt like kind of ahead of its time, kind of like narratively along the lines of something like Tron or The Matrix. And it had that very distinctive Macintosh thing going where a lot of sound effects were just created by someone recording audio into a microphone because Macs could do that so easily. And so you just have like this very weird kind of like custom bespoke kind of game. It just felt very, very warm and interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm just making that up, but have you ever played it, Jared? I feel like you were the most likely to.
Yeah, Systems Twilight I've played. That came along, but not, it was not contemporaneous for me. That came along later. And I agree with you. It's it doesn't get enough praise. Although I see it when I read like old Mac gaming forums, I see it brought up more and more. I think people are rediscovering it more as a legend. I think more people are watching it than playing it. At this point, you know, because it's emulating old Macs isn't always the easiest thing in the world.
I had real trouble doing it.
Yeah. And so I don't think you get a lot of chance to play it. And my own memories of it are many years old, but I do remember enjoying it quite a bit, finding it kind of provocative, if I remember right.
Well, there you go. And also, I believe both the Ultima and King's Quest series kind of reached their end this year. Did King's Quest go on beyond 7, or was there an 8?
No, there was one more beyond it called Mask of Eternity, but we don't talk about Mask of Eternity.
Okay, so King's Quest came to its end.
Yeah.
Ultima came to its end.
Ultima got like a 9 after this, I think, but it was also terrible.
Yeah, this is where Ultima came to its end.
Right, yeah.
The last good Ultima game. No platforming, just role-playing adventures.
I would argue that Serpent Isle is that even 8's not great. The Serpent 7-2 is the last good one.
Yeah, that's 7, Ultima 7 is like peak, right? That's the really
Yeah. No, I'm thinking Wizardry 8 is the one that everyone thinks is
Wizardry
amazing.
8's really good. Yeah, yes. No, Ultima 7, 1, and 2 are both very good.
Very sad. They're so Ultima 7 games. The shambling corpse, the zombie corpse of Ultima, slogging away at 8 before bringing us 9. And finally, Ultima Online, which was the part where it got good again.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a lot of stuff happening in 1994. We really kind of dashed past a lot, but honestly, a lot of the stuff we've already had full episodes on. Like I was thinking, I want to talk about Lunar Eternal Blue. But then I said, actually, maybe that should be a full episode. And then I realized we actually had a Lunar episode. So yeah, 94 is... has been very fertile for Retronauts coverage in the past. So
yeah.
There's still some things in here that we need to touch on. Like I've been meaning to do a Shin Megami Tensei 1 and 2 and so on and so forth episode for ages. I'm going to do that in 2024, by God. Maybe there should be a Mickey Mania podcast. No.
That's nonsense.
Who wants
that
to talk about Mickey? Oh, okay.
I think we have sort of done that with John and Thomas. But we may not have got to Mickey Mania. I mean, Mickey Mania is like the end of good Disney games for a long time, really.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, the one thing I want to mention in the sort of jip camp is Kid Klown in Crazy Chase, because I friggin' love Kid Klown in Crazy Chase, and no one ever talks about it.
Is that better than Kid Klown in Nightmare World?
Everything's better than Kid Klown in Nightmare World. But no, it's an isometric running game on the Super Nintendo full of like weird little secrets and funny animations and daft as a brush, great fun. Also, love Dynamite Heady from this year, but that's an episode at some point because I was obsessed with Dynamite Heady. Obsessed.
So any final thoughts on the year 1994 before we say farewell for another year and reconvene in 2024 December to talk about 1995?
It was good, wasn't it?
It occurs to me that 1994 was the year I graduated high school, which means it was also the year I went to college, which means it was also the year that I got my first email address and then sent my first email. So really, we're coming up on 30 years of me being an online person, which is seems like a lot.
Yeah, actually, come to think of it, I got online in 1994 for the first time, discovered the World Wide Web, which was still a little baby. And the first thing I did was try to find a website about King Crimson. And I remember finding a little 64 by 64 pixel scan of the cover of In the Court of the Crimson King. And I was like, wow, cool. Someone on the internet has heard of King Crimson. I don't feel alone anymore.
It was great. That's really quite sweet. And then
I became a terminally online.
I mean, for me, looking, given what we've gone over here and what we haven't gone over here, I would like to volunteer that this may be one of the best years ever for gaming. Sheer number of 10 out of 10s that have just dropped on this list, like stuff we've barely even touched on, like Final Fantasy VI and, like, you know, System Shock and Sonic 3 and Knuckles, like, for me, up there with the very best games that have ever been made.
Yeah, again, we've covered so many of these games in their own standalone episodes, yes. Super Metroid, etc. Just, there's so much quality and depth of content here. And even though the console industry was kind of struggling at this point, that was on the business side. It was not on the creative side. Like the 16-bit consoles had hit their true maturation point here. And everyone who was making good games knew how to make great games and really get the most out of that hardware. And so it was that kind of peak era you got back then with the older consoles where everyone had finally figured out how to harness the limitations of the technology and squeeze the most potential out of the machines. And yeah, just great design, great tech, just, you know, the kind of the peak.
And 94 was also, I think, another one of those great sum of its parts years, where we in Retronauts tend to break things down year by year in these episodes because it's the formatting for the new year. But we were living in a world in 94 where if you walked in an arcade, again, it was 1990 through 1994 arcade games. It was that last true lifeblood arcade era. There were still Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat machines in there. There was still, you know, all these things you associate with that era were hanging around. And if you walked into a game store, every great Super Nintendo game not called, you know, Chrono Trigger or Mario RPG was on the shelf staring at you in brilliant colors.
Yeah.
And it was just such a time to be playing games. You were just surrounded by excellence wherever you went. And that was really cool. It had been a really fertile time. And you were kind of getting to enjoy that last gasp of it before a new generation started. And everything got really weird. And frankly, with 3D, games got really strange for a while. The next couple of years in gaming were very, very different than anything that had come before.
I think if you read, like, games magazines from this era, like EGMs, for example, there is just so much happening. So many games coming out for so many different systems, like probably like 15 individual friggin' systems.
Magazines were this thick.
Yeah, phone book sized, and there's not a single bit of space that isn't full of screenshots or words of, you know, and ads, obviously. Like, ads out the ass, but like, that's just, that's commerce for you. But it's an incredible time for gaming. Like, everything is crazy. Like, you don't know what's going to be the winner in the console sort of arms race yet. You know, even stuff like the Laser Active was still hanging around and being covered. And it's mad and great and wild. And it's well worth revisiting.
Yeah, I don't know that we really got to do 1994 justice here, but that's the breaks. We'll just have to, you know, cover some more of these games in standalone episodes. But that is all the time we have here in 2023 to talk about 1994. So you'll just have to make the most of it and look forward to next year's year-in-review reviews, because we'll be revisiting those once again. So thank you for your time, Jared Diamond and Stuart. Please tell us where we can find you on the internet here in the year 2023 and going into 2024. Diamond, please kick us off.
Well, I'm saying it right now out loud, I am hoping to be even more online and more visible in 2024. That means more podcasts and more streaming and more everything. So thank you again for 2023, everybody. It was a really good year, and I look forward to what's coming in the fours. Lucky number four. But if you want to find me on the internet for now, until I get a website again, you can just look for me at all the various services. Look up Fight Club, F-E-I-T. That's my last name, C-L-U-B. That's a noun or a verb that you already know.
All right, Stuart.
Hello. Yes, you can hear me on Retronauts. You can find my writing on Retronauts, or you can buy my extremely good book, All Games Are Good, which is about how every game that I've ever played and you've ever played is actually good. And if you disagree, I'm afraid you're wrong. It's good. There are no bad games. And that's available from Limited Run Games in hardback or on Amazon in paperback. They're both very excellent versions. It really does come down to preference, but I go for the hardback because if you don't like the book, you can use it for more like, you know, useful things like propping things up or like a brick for a wall, perhaps. I don't know.
Yes, your book is almost as thick as a 1994 EGM.
Yeah, almost, but not quite. Almost. And it covers maybe slightly fewer games, only a few hundred.
But since we're Americans and it's social media, our next promotional video is going to be taking your book out and shooting it with various kinds of guns to see how far the bullets go through, just to test the protective factor.
That sounds amazing. Speaking of Limited Run Games, Jared, where can we find you? Could it be at Limited Run Games?
Yeah, it could be at Limited Run Games, or I make videos about shooting Stuart's book. I make books. I help out with that process. I help Stuart make his book. I help Kevin make his book. You can find those at limitedrungames.com. I hope you do. They're really good books, and you should read them. If you're listening to this in particular, you're just going to like those books. If you hung around through all this episode, these are the books for you. So please get them. They're wonderful and reasonably priced. And then I do fun stuff on the internet over I'm on Threads and Blue Sky, Instagram. You can find me at Petty Comma Jared, where I rant about various and sundry topics.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet, as always. You don't really need the spiel here, but I will say you can find me on, not on Twitter, but on Blue Sky as jparrish.busky.social. I do love my busky. wow, that sounds really rude. Yes, Blue Sky. That's where I'm posting these days. I have 1/10 the followers that I did on Twitter, and that's fine because I have 0% of the Nazis. And that rules. So, that's it. 1994. What a year, by golly. Thanks, everyone, for listening through another year of Retronauts. If you have not checked out our 1974 and 2004 episodes, please do so. They are available on fine Patreon and public feeds, I believe. So check those out. Enjoy. And we'll be back again very soon with another episode that is also about old things, but not quite as rigidly defined to the calendar as this one.